Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pro Photo Show number 76, Pro Photo Show Live, our very first live episode. Good to have you on board. We got a great panel of photographers today. I'm here, as usual, Gavin Syme, and we have Kerry Garrison from over at CameraDojo.com. Welcome, Kerry. Good to have you on board.
Good to be here.
And our very own Dennis Zerwas from DZPix.com. Hello, Dennis.
Hello, Gav.
And we also have Barry Howell. Now, Barry Howell's having some audio issues at the moment, but Barry from Picture Place Studios in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities area, will be on with us shortly as soon as he gets his audio issues worked out. As I said on Pro Photo Show 75 when I announced this show, it's kind of new. I've been talking about doing the live show for over a year now, I think, and procrastinating due to concerns over technical issues and stuff like that. We're here streaming live on TalkShoe, which is a popular tool for doing live call-in shows like this, and we are going to be taking calls as we get into the show here, but just had to experiment with it a little, make sure we understood how it worked. And as I said in the last show, it may be a little bit of a fiasco here, but we're going to have some fun, and we're going to talk shop. We're going to get the panel going and get everything rolling just like a normal roundtable. There's a chat room in here, so everybody can kind of talk as we go along, and then as we get a little bit further in, we're going to start taking some calls and questions and things like that and get you guys involved a bit in the show here on Pro Photo Show Live. So it is Thursday, March 24th, 2010. Welcome to Pro Photo Show.
Was I supposed to beatbox the intro or just go with it?
Was that Soundboard Sammy or was that you, Dennis?
That was me, actually.
That was actually pretty awesome. Do a little more of that.
You are listening
Welcome
to the
Pro Photo Show.
Yeah.
Shutters. All right. Excellent. Excellent. Now, that will probably be cut out in the podcast edition.
What?
For the benefit, you know, probably I won't. You know me. For the benefit of the live listeners, we needed to have a little bit of intro music. That's normally where the intro music would go.
Welcome to Pro Photo Show, the resource for professional and enthusiast photographers, a member of the Blueberry Network and the Tech Podcast Network. For show notes, tips, forums, and more, visit us online at profotoshow.net.
And we should have our very own Barry Howell on board now. Barry, are you there with us?
I am here.
Excellent. Dennis, let me shout out to you since you've been listening to me. I'm not distorting or anything weird like that on this new interface. You guys are all sounding good. I just want to make sure I'm not going to have an editing nightmare later.
It won't be like a nightmare. It'll just be like a
bad dream.
Yeah. Not like a night terror, but just like a regular old bad dream. You're like, oh, I forgot to bring the trash out kind of thing. So you're fine.
What you're saying is it's not the dream where you're naked in the grocery store, but you might be in your underwear.
Okay, I think we're ready for some photo questions.
I thought everybody's had that dream. Sorry. Let's move on here on Pro Photo Show. We got some things to talk about. We're going to cover a little bit of news, a few things that are going on, and then we're going to jump in and just kind of, I think, open the floor and talk about whatever. One thing I noticed today, I was looking through a few news feeds and stuff, and I noticed these 64 to 128 gigabyte SD cards are now available. They're a few hundred dollars, but that is a huge SD card, not a huge news story. I'm going to post this in the chat up here, and just kind of cool. That 128 gigabytes is a huge SD card. You could do, like a couple of weddings on one card and risk losing that one card and losing everything, but you could do that. There's an interesting Ansel Adams. Remember the guy that bought the Ansel Adams negatives?
This
was last summer or something at a yard sale. And I saw this interesting story that I thought I would post up there where apparently he came to a settlement with the Ansel Adams estate. And ultimately what happened is he verified that these were, or presumably verified through experts, that these were Ansel Adams images, these glass negatives. And I linked this in the chat room too. It'll be linked in the show notes. But the Ansel Adams estate, I guess, sued him or was going to sue him because he was using the name. He was making prints from the negatives and selling them as Ansel Adams, which I guess makes sense if they're Ansel Adams prints. But bottom line is, in this settlement, he agreed not to use the Ansel Adams name on these prints. And I don't know exactly what to say about this or whether this is good or bad. I just think it's interesting that here he bought these negatives and he can't use the name, even though that's who these photos were made by. And it kind of brings up the idea of the copyright thing and stuff a little bit. And also, I haven't looked into this. I don't know how copyright works in terms of film. If you have an old film and you own the negative, does that mean you own the rights even if you didn't take the photo?
And then also, these are so old, though I don't know if they fall outside of copyright range yet. Does anybody have any input on this? I just thought it was kind of interesting, and I would bring it up.
It is interesting, and it could open the door for all kinds of different types of lawsuits and things of this sort as technology changes and laws change. It's going to be interesting to see how it falls out.
Right. It's fascinating. And this guy already made a settlement, whether it was money involved or whether he just didn't want to deal with a court case over photos he bought at a yard sale or whatever. But it's interesting. And I think now on more recent photos, I should know this. I don't know what the copyright length is, since technically photos are copyrighted by default. Although if you wanted to take them to court, you'd have to have them registered in the copyright office. But by the nature of clicking the shutter, that photo does become yours from a strictly legal perspective. And I believe now that is, what, 50 or 75 years? Or I'm not sure if anybody knows exactly the number of time on that. Yeah, but anyway, it's an interesting story. I'll link it in the show notes. And Barry, do you have any input on this, or should we just move on?
No, I think that I've heard that 50-year number kicked around before. I'd have to check back. I'll talk to Larry about it, and maybe we can put something up on the website about that, because he is quite expert in this field of copyright stuff.
Yeah, that could be cool. And it also just brings up an interesting question of logic. I mean, at what point should this line be drawn? Because if copyright at some point gets in the way of history, is that a problem? I mean, so where should this line be drawn? Dennis, any thoughts?
Not on this one. In one way, it's weird that he would use the name Ansel Adams and make money from it. And the other part of me thinks, why wouldn't the Ansel Adams family want to purchase those from him to keep them in the family and keep using the name, kind of thing? So that, right. I don't know. Every time we've talked about it, it comes up. It just seems that there's some new twist in these found negatives.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's an interesting story that keeps developing a bit. And what I take home from all of it, and the fact that it's made such a big deal about, is I keep looking at this saying, gosh, how can I make my landscapes in such high demand that people are like fighting over them like this? So I'm working on that. And we'll do a special podcast on that once I figure that out. Another link I just posted, and will also be in the show notes, is to this story over on F-Stoppers about the stolen scream. I think a lot of you have probably seen this, kind of a copyright issue as well. And this guy that took this photo, he took this photo of, I believe it was a self-portrait, and it was of him screaming, and he posted it on Facebook, and people started using it, and it's gotten to the point where this photo is used all over the world, sometimes in pop art and graffiti on walls, but in advertisings, in I think even in some movies it showed up, and it's this guy's image that's been pilfered and I suppose modified and all this kind of stuff. But very interesting, this photographer, Naam Belayi, I believe is how you pronounce his name. And check out that video. It's fascinating. And again, it brings up this idea of, especially on the commercial side, gosh, people, do you think you can just take something and use it just because it's online? And it's almost like they use that play dumb kind of excuse in a lot of areas. I mean, we've talked about in the past how I dealt with an infringement before where somebody just took my photo and used it on the website, and they were telling me that because it was on the internet, it was fair game. Ultimately, I had PPA get a hold of them. I think I gave you guys an update on this, but ultimately what happened is I sent them a bill. It wasn't extravagant. It was just like $150 or something for usage, and they were refusing to pay it, and I sticked PPA on them, and they just sent them some letters and stuff. PPA doesn't actually go to court for you or anything, but ultimately they did pay the bill. And it just is interesting, because when you watch this video, this is on a whole other level. I mean, this is used by so many people, and it's a photo that was stolen so many times. It's just crazy.
That kind of reminds me of the Obama thing, where the guy took that Obama picture and modified it. It became the poster, and there was that whole debacle.
Did they not pay him for that either?
I think there was some settlement after the fact, but it was not disclosed what it was.
Strange. Yeah, it's really weird to me that there's this mindset that you can just take stuff. And I think people need to stand up for this. I mean, we don't have to have this mindset of you have to sue everybody. But I think part of it is if everybody just starts standing up and quits having this attitude that I'm privileged because you use my photo and says, no, you have to pay me for the photo. I'm dealing with something right now that I haven't responded yet, but I just got an email on one of my Seattle panoramas that a guy sent me, and he wants to use it for his wedding site. He said, hey, can I use this for a wedding site I'm building for my friends in Seattle? And on the one side, and I'm still debating this, on the one side I can say, yeah, go ahead, no big deal. But the first email I sent him is actually said, absolutely, yeah, I'd love to have you use it. Not a real heavy use thing, so I won't charge you too much for licensing, probably about $50. And so, and I just acted like he should expect that. And he mailed back and said, well, that's actually quite a bit. I was just, it's not going to be even up for very long. I just want to kind of use it for free. And I haven't responded yet. And it's not that it's a big deal, but to me, it's more the mindset of thinking that a photo should be free. And I think we should quit giving things away because we want our ego to be stroked and because somebody used our photo. I know I'm putting it kind of bluntly, but isn't that what this comes down to sometimes?
You're right, yeah, but it depends. And this is one of those, it depends. You know, it depends.
I would
on,
agree.
Is it a commercially viable image? If not, am I going to care? You know, probably not. Is it a good representation of my work that I want out there? Is it going to generate some goodwill that may turn into other paid work down the road? And there's so many things to consider when giving away your images. I mean, I do a lot of volunteer work. I got one this weekend and next weekend, the following weekend. But there's reasons why I do it. There's an agenda behind it. It's not 100% just because I'm a super nice guy. Mostly it's because my wife volunteers me. But it's, you know, I mean, I build a client base or I build a mailing list out of it, and we get some business out of it. And so there's a trade-off. And if it's just a one-way street, then if it's not going to benefit you, why do it?
Well, and I understand. And I'm not saying that I never volunteer for photos. And I'm not even saying I'm very good at saying no. I'm just bringing up this idea. And I think, you know, certainly volunteering to do stuff and getting involved and stuff like that is a good thing. But there's this outlook that because somebody asks you to take photos, there's almost this mindset in the asker's mind that they're doing you a favor by asking you, and you should be happy to do it for free a lot of times. And that's what's frustrating to me, is this mindset. Northern Horse in the chat says, how can people take his images and make money from it? That's a really good question, but it happens. And it happens, I think, more often than we realize. And this is an extreme case. And it is a little disheartening to watch, because essentially this guy kind of has this mindset of, well, yeah, I'm not really happy that everybody stole my photos, but it's nice that they're being appreciated. And the problem is, it's so easy to fall into this trap of, oh, I'm glad my art's being appreciated so everybody can steal it. I think that we devalue ourselves by doing that, really.
The way I look at it personally is, if someone's going to use one of your images and they're going to use it to make money to better help their business, then I don't feel ashamed putting a price tag on it, because they're going to get to use that, and it's going to make them money. And like Carrie said, there's certain situations where it's a personal call, and you make that call yourself. But I really do think if the person's going to benefit from your image, you know, I often say, I'm getting more in the habit of saying that the house payment doesn't get made by bylines, you know.
Exactly. And Northern Horse, that's pretty concisely putting it. The reason that's why it's disheartening, because he's given up on the value of his work. And I see that a lot. And I'm not saying never. I mean, I've given my work to be published in a magazine before, or they've used it on the cover or something like that, one of my landscapes here and there. But I get credit for it. So I've been like, okay, this isn't a real big production, and I'm getting advertising for this. So it's kind of a trade. Now, somebody in the magazine business, there was a recent article by a big sports shooter, and gosh, I can't remember his name right now, but this is hurting their industry too, because people will just give their sports photos to magazines and stuff to be used for free, because there's this attitude that, oh, cool, I'm going to get published. So I'm not saying I have all the answers on where that drawn is line, but we can't give up on the value of good work. We need, you know, if we're putting all this effort and time and money into making great images, we need to put some value on it. So,
well,
anyway,
and Gavin, just another interesting wrinkle that's happened here in Minnesota in the last two, I think it's now been 3 years. The Minnesota State High School League now has a referendum blanket policy in place that when you are credentialed as a photographer to come and shoot pictures at any high school state tournament, they own exclusive and total rights to your images, and you are not allowed to sell them.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Nope. I can go and shoot pictures for the little high school yearbook, and but I am not allowed to sell them. There was a photographer a couple of years ago who was at one of the state tournaments that I was shooting pictures at, and she shot a bunch of pictures. She posted them on a website to try and sell them to the families. The high school league sniffed it out in about half a day, and she got a packet from them with a cease and desist letter, and basically they threatened to pull her credentials for life if she didn't pull all the images down within a matter of days. She also had to, and it, she had them post on PhotoReflect. They contacted PhotoReflect as well and demanded a complete accounting so that in the event had any images been sold, which they she hadn't sold any yet, and, you know, they were going to bust her chops over that as well.
Okay, now what is this credential that they were threatening to take away?
Your media credentials as a photographer, because when, like, the State Boys High School Hockey Tournament, it's a great example. There's 140,000 people that attend that thing over 3 days, and it's at the Xcel Energy Center where, you know, the Minnesota Wild play. It's a big deal. It's a big event, and you cannot walk in there with a camera unless you have media credentials, and then the State High School League prevents you from being able to sell it. So you can only literally cover it for media purposes, not for selling pictures.
See, and that's just nuts, and what bothers me is coming back to photographers giving up, is that they tolerate this kind of crud, and that if all the photographers said, no, we will not shoot under these conditions, and they all walked away.
Sure, but that's never going to happen, because you've got photographers who are being paid by the major newspapers in town, by Sports Illustrated that covers it regularly. They're going to abide to it. They don't care. They're not selling pictures off it.
I don't even see how they avoid getting sued, because you cannot, I can't make a rule that says if you're within 10 feet of me, any photos you take, I own the copyright to. It's not legitimate unless you have a contract that you've agreed to with me. I don't even see, I mean, I guess I would probably say, go ahead, pull my credentials. They're my photos. You have nothing to say about it.
Yeah, but if this is a venue and it's not a open air public venue, then it's private property, and they can decide what their rules of photography are on their property.
Okay, fair enough, but if this is the state, it's not private. It belongs to the people, and they have no right to say that, in my opinion. If this is the NFL, I might be irritated, but I say, okay, it's their private property. But I'm getting the impression that this is like a school/state/county/city event, and they don't have the right to say that.
Well, they may not have the right, but they do it. You know,
I'm inclined to say if somebody went this far that they wouldn't win in court, because I don't think that, and I'm not a legal expert, but I don't see the state having jurisdiction to say we own the copyrights to any photos taken here when they're operating an area that's a public place.
All right. I understand, but now here's another question.
Angry.
Well, it should, but, you know, whatever. Get over it. You know, you just deal with it. Hey, but we ran across something. How many of you guys who are on this little show right now are using SmugMug?
Present.
I have a SmugMug account, and I've dabbled with it. I don't actively use it.
And I know our friend Northern Horse Lara there is a big SmugMuggy, and one of the little tidbits that we ran across, because we're beginning to explore using it quite a bit more than we have ever in the past, we noticed a little tidbit on the SmugMug Pro startup page that there is any single event that has 500 or exceeds 500 photographs may result in a patent infringement, and owned by one Peter Gregg that has nothing to do with SmugMug, but he's the guy that makes the bounce cards. And it's the most bizarre thing. Somehow he was able to get a patent that says anybody, apparently on the internet, anywhere, that loads an event with 500 more images could potentially be in violation of a patent infringement on a patent that he owns. And I haven't looked up the details of the patent yet. We were assured by SmugMug it's never been a problem. But
well,
how bizarre is that?
Yeah, that's crazy, but what's new with the patent office? They're constantly giving patents on ridiculous things. I mean, what if somebody files a patent on going to the bathroom and they own that patent? What are the rest of us going to do? I'm going to be in, you know, I just don't
hold
know.
It. Just hold it. Just hold it, Gab. You can do it. You travel the
I'd
last,
be,
last fall.
I'd be
how long? 75 years?
Just try it. You don't know if they try it. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
I've tried it.
So, no. I don't know.
Okay, moving on.
Yep,
no,
all pretty crazy.
That's crazy. I don't know what to say. If, Barry, if you have a link about that, please post it in the chat room and send it to me so that I can put it in the show notes, because that is interesting. It doesn't strike me as one of those things. It strikes me as a crazy patent that probably won't go anywhere. But the fact is, there shouldn't be any patent for any such things.
The method of uploading can be patented. You know, the
right,
encryption
exactly, yeah.
Or storage or compression can be patented. But the fact that it's 500 images...
Yeah, that's just nuts. And I can't remember ever having a gallery that had that many images, because I sort and edit and all that kind of stuff. But there's situations where you would. So anyway, it's strange. But let's move on, I guess. Oh, one more link I'm going to put this is right here. And let me find it for you. On this Stolen Scream article, what he actually used to find a lot of these was TinEye.com, which is a pretty cool website. We may have mentioned this before. It's been around for a couple years, but it's a reverse image search, and you can go and put the URL for a direct URL to one of your images into here, or you can upload an image, and it will search for similar images. Now, here's the thing. It has a huge database of images, but it doesn't have every image out there. So unless your image is actively being used all over the place, it may not show up in here. But still, it's a good tool, and it seems to be getting better as time goes on. So check that out, TinEye.com, TinEye.com is kind of a cool tool for that. If any of you in the chat room, if you guys have want to input on this or something, feel free to raise your hand, and we can get you in here on the call. A lot of you don't have audio, I see. Just for the record, those of you that are listening live to the show, and actually we got a pretty good group here. What is there? I don't know what the number is here, but there's a nice group of listeners here. You can... use the TalkShoe app. If you're on TalkShoe, you have to have a TalkShoe account, and you can use the TalkShoe app, and the chat windows are a little bit more fluid, and you can actually call in directly from your computer. And then if you're just using the pop-up window from their website, you can call in too from a regular phone. Probably a little easier to do it from the computer, because then we can just add you in. You can raise your hand up in there and actually get in the queue for talking. But if anybody's wanting to talk as we go along here, feel free to raise your hand, and we'll try and get you in here soon. And keep that chat room going. This is great.
And I just want to say, I just posted a link to FredMiranda.com. Had done a little write-up on this, and I'll stand corrected. It was not Peter Gregg. It's Peter Wolf, one of those Peters of Photo Crazy, Inc. So it has a whole information about this. Uploading more than 500 photographs of participants in a single sporting event may require a license from Photo Crazy.
Wow. It's amazing the things that patents are given out for. We can come back to the whole thing of why is the school telling people who can take photos? Why are governments giving patents out that are crazy? I mean, then we could get into a whole shebang of things. So I guess we'll move on, but pretty interesting. Also posting in the chat room, I don't want to go on too much about this, but you guys know we've been talking about this X100 from Fuji. I'm going to put a link in there, and there's some sample images over on DP Review, and they have some ones where they took a sequence of the same image at different ISOs, and gosh, even at ISO 6400, this thing is looking good. So that's pretty intriguing, and if you're interested in that, you can take a look at it. Other than that, does anybody else have any interesting new stories or things they want to bring up or mention before we move on to other things?
I'm just waiting for the 5D Mark III to come out so I can get a 5D Mark II for cheap.
Well, you know what? It's about due, I would think. And actually, since you mentioned that topic, just real quick, I'm not trying to segue into lenses falling off right now. I will try and avoid that for now. But 5D Mark III, I would imagine, is going to be coming, gosh, must be the next 6 to 9 months or something. It seems like they're about due. And what I'm excited about is more megapixels. You know, I'm kind of eating crow a little bit, because a couple years ago I was kind of saying the megapixel war is over, and then I started doing a lot more large prints and looking at the resolution of film and stuff like that, and I've realized that digital still has a long way to go. But I'm hoping the 5D Mark III gets up in the 30 megapixel range, which is better, because I'm actually pushing my 21 megapixels on the Mark II frequently to not as much resolution as I need. And then I'm also wondering about the 1D Mark IVS, I think it will be called, I'm really wondering what's happening there, because it's strange. Generally, when they release a 1D series, they released the high-resolution version shortly after, is the way I remember it. And I can't imagine they're selling very many of the 1D Mark IIIs, because the 1D Mark IV has some perks that are pretty significant over the 1D Mark III. So it's pretty dated right now, and it seems like people are waiting. So I don't know if they ran into some technical issues. I've heard rumors that they're doing some really, really serious changes and some rebuilding. They're really gonna wow us with something new, and maybe even a whole new model. I don't know if anybody's heard anything on this, but it'll be interesting to see what's coming, because I think in this next year we're gonna get up into maybe the 30, 35 megapixel range in the SLR style bodies.
I just don't think we're gonna see it in the 5D Mark III. I mean, in the high end, absolutely, but the 5D Mark III, I mean, if it's in the mid 20s, that's where I'm expecting it's gonna fall. But I think they're gonna really improve the video, probably 60 or 120 frames per second. Support, things like that.
Gosh, I hope they do more than that, because the video is already great in the 5D Mark II, and I guess maybe that's the direction they're going. I like the video now, but I'm way more concerned about, you know, when I buy a camera, I buy it for photos. It's likely, it seems like they'll go 26, 28 megapixels, somewhere in that range on the 5D Mark III. I hope they do more. It'll be interesting. I just am wanting more resolution so bad that I'm actually even looking at medium format digital, but it gets very expensive. You can buy like a medium format HASI that gets up into the 60, 70, even 80 range. I think they have one, but you know, you're going to plunk down $30,000 on that. And Barry, this is one you might appreciate. I went down to Ken Whitmire's studio the other day, and I was teaching him some Lightroom stuff. And Ken Whitmire's kind of my wall portrait mentor. I've talked about him before. He does the wall portrait conference and all that. So I went down there, and we went down to his camera storage room, and ridiculous amounts of old film gear. I mean, I'm not talking about a few cameras on shelves. There was more 6x7 cameras than I could count. I didn't even try. And just like shelves filled with this stuff. We were looking at view cameras because I want to borrow a 4x5 view from him to do this large format stuff. And it really struck me, guys, why there's so many photographers now, because we're looking in this room and he's showing me cameras. There's this one camera he had that was an old aerial camera, and it used rolls of 4x5 film. And I'm talking 4x5 inches. These are big Hirken negatives. They're awesome. And this camera was this big heavy-duty military camera. He actually started doing aerial photography in the military, I believe it was. And it looks like, you know, the orange roadside cones? It looked like a stubby one of those that was made out of metal, had a tiny lens, and you actually held this thing like up against your body. It probably weighed 20 or 30 pounds, and it had like a sight that flipped up, which was the equivalent of your viewfinder. And this thing was just unreal. And then we were looking at these view cameras. Some of them weighed like 30 pounds, and I'm wanting to borrow this view camera, and he's kind of saying, well, you're going to have to practice on this. You know, this is not a real simple thing. So he actually sent me home with a 4x5 sheet film holder, and I'm like, so can I have a little bit of light in the room when I load this? because this shooter motor it's not like a memory card, guys. You have a thing that's about 5x7 inches, and I actually posted it on the SimFX Facebook page, a photo of this. You have a thing that's 5x7 inches that holds 4x5 loose sheets of raw film that's unexposed, and you pull the slide back, and you have to go into a 100% dark room. Open up the doors. You have everything in place. You have to open up the box of film in the dark, and you feel for the edge of the corner that has the indent, and you have to slide it in and then close it, and you do all this, and you have two frames in this film holder. And so I'm like going into my bathroom in the dark practicing loading film so I can get two shots, and I'm thinking, gosh, now I know why in the old days everybody wasn't a photographer, because you actually had to like learn. You had to go to school just to learn how to load the film.
This is just music to my ears.
Anyway, I just thought that was interesting, and I thought Barry would enjoy that. But I just thought it was an interesting observation in how things have changed. The craft of knowing how to really make a great image hasn't changed so much, and that's what a lot of the starting out weekend warrior $500 wedding photographers do not have a grasp on. But it's so much easier just to make an okay photo than it used to be, that everybody's doing it, and we've talked about this 100 times. The standard has been brought down, but it's very interesting. So
I think it's funny that he sent you home with the film plate so you could like learn how to do it, like it's like how Mr. Miyagi taught
The Karate Kid, how to like to scrub the floor, and then that ends up being, you know, his move. I like how he's like, no, you're not ready for this, son. Let's just get send you home with a plane, first of all.
Well, part of it was because he hadn't got in there in so long, he couldn't find everything he was looking for. I mean, he had five or six, you know, 4x5 view cameras in there, and they were all in boxes, but he couldn't find the one we were looking for.
So, I think he knew where they were. I think he was just teaching the apprentice very slowly.
Well, you know what? Then I didn't even know this was in this building. I've been in this building because they have the conference there every year, and it's a big studio, big old backyard. But there's a door off to the right that I'd never been in. There's this door over there. Yeah. So he was trying to find a film hoarder. He opens the door, and there is a dark room that just goes on forever. I mean, like I say, this was a big operation, and they had color stuff. And there's a bath that they washed prints in that's like a third the size of my office. And I'm looking in that, and I walked into this, and I'm looking around kind of in awe at all this stuff. And now it's kind of a storage room, so it's a huge mess, and we're tripping over stuff trying to get around in there. And there's these big enlargers, and there's hoses hanging from the ceiling where they washed prints. And it wasn't so foreign because I've seen it in, like, Ansel Adams books and stuff. But I'm just like, wow, I didn't even know this was here, first of all. But also it struck me all this stuff that they had in there, they could make somewhere in the range of 20 by 30 prints is what they were set up to do on a regular basis. And it occurred to me that here, right where I'm sitting in Syme Studios Command Center right now, I'm looking at this computer. I have my IPF 8300 off to the left here, and I can make prints five times the size with just sitting here. I can just sit here and run these off, and it's changed so much. There's no chemicals. There's none of this or that, and it's just mind-boggling to see how much it's changed in the past 15, 20 years. And I guess for somebody like you who's been in the industry for a while, it's changed all that much more.
That is true.
Very
true. You bring up an interesting point, Gavin, when you went through that whole explanation of what it takes to just load the film in that camera, and so many people today can't reach up behind them and adjust their flash down one stop.
I know.
They don't know their camera well enough to do basic adjustments without looking at it.
Well, and part of it, I think, is in the old days, it took some skill, you know, not that you couldn't learn it, but it took some skill just to make an image that was decent. So there was more of a mindset of, yes, you actually have to learn something. Now there's a mindset of, I bought a camera and that makes me cool. And it's really sad to see because, you know, if you want to be a professional photographer, that's great. But the industry, let's face it, the industry's saturated right now. You better find a way to stand out, and you better do your job well. You better learn your marketing. And don't think just because you have a camera and you take a few good photos and put them on Facebook and people pat you on the back for them that you have this craft down, because it takes years and years and years and years to really know what you're doing. That doesn't mean you can't have fun with it or that you shouldn't aspire to be professional. I don't want to be too discouraging here, but we also want to be in reality about how involved it is. But anyway, lest I get off on a tangent. Anybody else? Let's see. A couple more things, actually, before we wrap up and go into general topics. Real quick, a little plug and kind of a news piece as well. The Lightflow presets for you Aperture users out there are now available. And a little bit of an ad, but got to keep things rolling around here and keep the bills paid. But my Lightflow presets are over at SimeFX.com. And it's a complete set. It's kind of to Apple Aperture what my Power Workflow presets are to Lightroom, and a whole set of presets. There's a video over there. There's sample images, all kinds of stuff over on the site. So head over and check that out if you're an Aperture user, because I think you're going to find it really useful. And to be honest, I was a little concerned that there wasn't enough Aperture users out there to warrant me making a full set for Aperture, and I'm kind of being proven wrong, because it's actually doing pretty well, and quite a few of you have been picking it up, and seems to be pretty well received so far. So I'm really excited about it. I spent quite a bit of time. It was actually very educational, because essentially I had to learn Aperture to be able to really get in there and dig in under the hood and make these presets really good. And there's a few things that I think Aperture has an edge on. I'll admit, I still like Lightroom better, and I think Aperture is really slow for me. I don't like the fluidness of it and the speed of which things operate, but there are some edges, too, that it has. For example, the curves. It has curves and levels, by the way, in RGB, whereas in Lightroom, we just have curves and luminance, and it's really cool to be able to do that RGB curves. You can really manipulate things in some different ways. That was just one of the things that stood out to me. But anyway, the Lightflow presets are available on the site. I will link those in the show notes for those of you interested, or you can just head over to SimeFX.com. And also real quick on the coming Lights and Shadows, the Last Chance is coming up here for the early registration discount on that, which is $299. Then it's going to go up. But that's a two-day workshop. It's coming to Oakland on the 16th and 17th of April. I'm going to be heading out and taking a month on the road. I'm going to be in Oakland. That one is booking up pretty good. I'm really excited about that one. It's going to be fun down in the San Francisco area, and we're going to spend a couple days on dynamic range and shadow and light and in the, behind the computer and out in the field and all kinds of stuff. And then that same workshop the following week, April 25th through the 26th, I'm coming down to the Pismo Beach area, and I'm going to be doing it down there as well. So if you can't make one, maybe you can make the other, and I'll put that in the show notes as well. But you can also find it on simfx.com or f164.com. And then also while I'm in Oakland, I'm doing the Lightroom Power Workshop, and you can find that there as well. Okay, so moving on, enough of the Gavin ads. Anybody else have anything to add before we just kind of open up the phone lines here? And let's get a few of you in here, and let's maybe get some questions or just some input and talk about a few things. For our listening audience, when the silence like that comes, it means one of the other panelists is supposed to speak up. But in this case, they didn't. So normally in the show, you don't hear that. Here's the thing. If you look at my iTunes reviews, sometimes I'm chastised for talking too much.
I was muted. In my defense, I was muted big time. I'll excuse you this time.
So occasionally, I insert significant pauses, and that's telling the other panelists, talk now so I don't get people irritated because they're listening to my voice too much.
Usually, we're pretty good about it, but... I flipped over, I was looking at the chat window, making sure that there were no questions there, and there was this uneasy silence. So I'll go ahead, I'll throw something out there while we're waiting for to see if any questions come in. I've been playing with the Wacom in 204, and I'm falling in love with this thing. It is a beautiful device, and just it's a joy to work with. Lightroom sort of kind of does some pressure sensitivity stuff, and I understand that's going to be like in an upcoming rev where it'll really have a lot more pen support or tablet support like that. But I never really was into tablets before because I'd only used really cheap ones, and having this quality of a tablet to work with and do the local adjustments, painting and things in Lightroom, wow, this tablet is just very, very cool. So I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah, actually, I got an Intuos 4 last year, too, and one of the things, I know this is the nerdy side, I don't use a tablet all the time because I'm so used to a mouse, but if you really want to get the fluid and, you know, the pressure sensitive, and if you're doing some really detailed painted work, it's sitting right here on my desk, and I would agree, it's a great tool. And what I love about the 4, now is it the 4? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the 4 that I have, is it has those OLEDs. It used to be you'd assign the buttons to what you wanted it to do and put stickers on it. Now you can actually assign those buttons, and they have tiny little screens next to the button that actually show what those buttons are assigned to.
The one I have doesn't have that, but it's just the sensitivity, the accuracy, the precision mode. It comes with a mouse, but... I was talking to one of the application specialists yesterday, and he's like, put that thing away and get used to using the pen, and after about 3 days, you'll never want to touch a mouse again.
That's been my problem, is I never can quite... I mean, it's great if I'm wanting to paint, but I always feel like I'm quicker on my mouse just for general stuff. So I tend to set it back there and just use it when I'm working details, but I know people say if you force yourself, pretty soon it's all you'll want to do. But now, what size of the Intuos did you get, Kerry?
I got the medium, about nine inch.
Like 9 by 12 or something?
If you look to the left of your pad, it should have, if it's the Intuos 4, it has a tiny screen there next to each key, and if you can configure it actually so it will show the icon for like the tool you're using or whatever on that little tiny screen, and it will change.
Does that actually change?
Awesome. Yeah, those change dynamically depending on the program you're in, and it's really awesome.
Oh, I'll have to play with that some more.
Yeah, it's really...
Yeah, I've been loving it.
Cool. Yeah, that's the nerdy part of it. That's actually why I bought the Intuos 4, because I already had an Intuos 3, and I saw that, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to have that. Anyway, okay.
And it's a beautiful looking device, too.
Yeah, it's very sleek. And there's a wireless one now, too, I believe.
Yeah, the Bluetooth. The desk that I have it on actually has a black top, and it's a black keyboard and a black monitor, so it fits really well on that station.
Excellent. Yeah, that's cool. All right, super. Let's go ahead and see. Do we have any questions or anything? Dennis, you've probably been watching the chat room a little better than I have.
Yeah, I do. If I'm unmuted this time, yes, I am. Okay. I have a question.
There's a question on this. It says, why does it work with the pen 2 inches off the pad? It would be better if the pen had to be on the pad to work.
No. Because if the pen is on the pad, then you'd be dragging stuff around.
Yeah. So you
can move the mouse.
Just above the pad to move it as a mouse, and I only touch it when it's actually like a mouse. You know, if I'm touching it, it's more like hitting the left mouse button. So as I touch the pad, it presses the left mouse button, and I can drag and I can do things. So it shouldn't have to be on the pad to work unless you like dragging and pushing harder, which doesn't quite seem right to me.
It can have to work that way. It takes a little getting used to, though. There's no question about it. But I think it does make sense when you stop and think about it. And Guest 7 says, what's the status of the workshop in April? I don't know. I just mentioned it. I'm not sure if you heard it. But yes, the workshop in April, which one are you talking about, the HDR workshop, or are we speaking of something else here? If you are talking about the HDR workshop, it is on the website. I just mentioned it. April 16th and 17th in the San Francisco area, and April 25th and the 26th in the Pismo Beach area. All the info and the video and all that kind of stuff and the registration is on simeffects.com on my site or on my fine art site, f164.com. And I posted links here in the chat, too. You may have seen those.
Gavin, I got to throw it in. I had a customer in this last few days ordering pictures, and we got talking cameras a little bit, and he asked me, I got to ask you, he goes, have you tried any of that fakey HDR photography? Fakey HDR photography.
Well, and that's a common problem, isn't it, with HDR? This is something more and more as I get into this detail stuff that I'm trying to hammer home pretty good, is that just because you can do something and edit doesn't mean you should. I mean, editing, just like anything else, people go out and they get a new set of Photoshop actions or presets or a new plugin or something like that, and they just go to town. And it's a balance. You know, I use my actions and preset stuff all the time, but I dial them back. You may not always know what I'm using because I'll really keep things mild. And HDR is one of those things that you gotta be subtle with, and that's definitely something we'll cover in the workshop to bring this back to a shameless plug. Okay. So
well done. I do have a question from guest 24 that was asked a while ago.
Yes.
That might be fun to just touch on. Is just if we go around and what people expect or kind of a wish list of what we hope Lightroom 4 is going to have, what kind of features. Now, that's probably not going to be till 2012 that they either announce that or release it. But what would you guys like to see be in Lightroom 4?
Well, I need a feature that does everything automatically, and so I don't even have to touch the photos. It actually makes the prints and sends them to the clients, and I can actually sit at home while watching TV, drinking Kool-Aid, and eating Cheetos, and my clients are being served by Lightroom's virtual assistant.
Perfect.
Wow.
Well, the cameras already take the image for you, so you're halfway there.
Yes. Basically, what I'm going for is a Roomba for photographers, and it does everything for me. Runs the studio, and soon I'm actually working on one that will even do the podcast. So I will actually be listening to the live stream of the podcast instead of podcasting. No, but seriously, sorry.
Are you serious? Because they're not going to do that in one version upgrade. Maybe like over the next 5 years.
Well, I mean, let's just say the connections I have say that there's some big changes to coming, and essentially what it's going to mean is when everyone's a photographer, no one will be. And no, this version will not build a studio, Northern Horse, but maybe version 5. But no, seriously, it's really hard to predict this kind of stuff, and I know it's easy to get excited about it, but
just one thing that you wish when you go into Lightroom, you're like, oh, I wish it did, boop, 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 what?
Wow, I really do. Other than I want it to be faster, which is my complaint with Lightroom and really my complaint with Aperture, because Aperture drives me crazy how slow it is. But other than the speed, I'm always for making the process better. But the process in Lightroom 3 I feel is so much closer to like film and less like digital as I analyze this stuff, and I'm sure there's room to improve. But I guess one area that I would like to see is really controlling artifacts. I mean, if you push your channels or if you push things too far, it will start getting artifacts and it starts looking very digital. And there are limitations when you're working with a RAW file. I mean, that's partly the RAW file. But just more refinements, I guess, in the processing and I think there's, I haven't really thought about this, to be honest. So, Dennis, why don't you guys tell me your desired features?
I wish it would, I wish you could search across multiple catalogs more easily for a picture.
And networking with catalogs, that's one that everybody's
because,
been wanting.
Frankly, that's something that I really like about Aperture. If I'm in Aperture, and I use both, and but I love the fact that when I fire up Aperture, I have all my projects that I have in Aperture are there and accessible. So if I'm working on something and then I get a call from somebody that says, hey, I need a picture from little XYZ emailed to me real quick for a little deadline I have, I don't have to quit it, find, okay, what catalog is that in? Where the heck is that picture? It's so much faster in Aperture to just go, oh, I know when, oh, within the last 6 months, within the last month. You know, all those little fun little deals that Apple has built into it are awful convenient when you're having to hunt down, you know, kind of random files now and then. And I do that with some frequency, and it bugs me when I'm in Lightroom because, you know, okay, great. What Lightroom catalog? Where is it? And searching in Lightroom is a bit of an adventure.
Yeah, and they could do some faces stuff like Aperture has. That would be kind of cool if it was good. Anybody else have any input, Carrie, or anything on Lightroom?
Yeah, I agree. Face recognition would be really good. The ability on an import to you to be able to apply different meta tags to different groups of images. Right now, it's all or nothing on an import. The ability when you do an import to specify, like have a filter. But if I'm shooting RAW plus JPEG for some particular reason, but I only want to import the RAWs, it won't do it. So I'd like a little more control over import filters in terms of the processing. The vignetting still is a little needs a little work. It's not as natural as it could be. That's kind of one of them. Some of the drawing tools, I think, could be improved. I think the tablet support, I mean, I hear that's coming, but I really want to see much improved support in that area. And, I mean, speed, of course. I mean, I don't care how fast it is. We're always going to want to be faster. So, it doesn't hurt me. I'm not frustrated with the speed, but definitely being able to have multiple catalogs and search across them, because I have every image over the past 5 years staying in one catalog, and it hasn't caused me a problem, but at the same time, you know, it's just, it's all there, and if something happens, I got to rebuild an entire catalog.
I'm a huge fan of separate catalogs. I teach that all the time, and when I do workshops, and you know, it's a personal choice. But you do I do a separate catalog for every job. We've talked about this in the past. Not for my large groupings of stuff like my landscape stuff. I have one catalog for my personal projects. But it would be if we could search across multiple catalogs like that. It would eliminate. That's really the only downside of having separate catalogs is that. So that would be really cool. Shortcuts, too. I think they need to get custom shortcuts like we have in Aperture, like we have in Photoshop. Honestly, I have no idea why there isn't currently custom shortcuts in Lightroom. There is a plugin that you can actually get from Timothy Arnaz. It's called, Keyboard Tamer from Timothy Arnaz, the Photographer's Toolbox. Keyboard Tamer is a plugin that will allow you to apply custom shortcuts to things. So there are some ways around it, but that should be built into the application.
A few suggestions. Oh, yeah. Go ahead. You're reading those out of the chat room. I was just going to mention
Yeah, I'm just looking. And you pick up a couple more, too. GPS, I think, would be great. And let me, because I've been using, not so much with portraits, but when I was on the road last fall, I started doing a lot with GPS. And actually, let me mention this. We're not to Picks of the Week yet, but I think this is kind of a good thing to mention on the note of GPS, because when you're out traveling, we drove 7,000 miles. Okay, it would have been really neat to have every single image GPS tagged. And I did get some of them that way, but I kind of started while we were on the road, and I didn't get it really worked out well. But there's no built-in GPS stuff in Lightroom. Something's crashing around over there. There's no built-in stuff, GPS stuff in Lightroom, and there should be, and a map would be cool too. But on the note of GPS, there's an app I use for the iPhone that's called Geotag Photos. Really nice app, really simple. And essentially what you do is it uses your iPhone, you turn this on, and it just starts recording essentially until you turn it off. Now, I ran into a few bugs with it, although there's been updates since then. Then what you can do is you have an account on their website. You can go download the log file. I've done some research on the best ways to handle this, because they have an app that you can use, a Java app that you can use on their website that will tag it into the metadata of your raw files. But I'm this whole Lightroom workflow guy. So what I'll do is I'll take the Geotag Photos app, and then I'll go in and I will use an application for Lightroom called DF Geoencoding Support. And I will put that in the show notes as well, because it's kind of a long name. But it's a Lightroom plugin that adds the metadata area for the GPS coordinates inside of Lightroom, and then it allows you to import the file that has your Lightroom GPS, excuse me, your GPS coordinates based on time structure of when those photos were taken. So obviously you have to be synchronized with the app that's recording the GPS coordinates and your camera, but then you import it and it applies all the GPS coordinates for those time slots, and it's a really cool app. I run into some problems where as I crossed over time zones, it changed. And the phone would change, but my camera was still on my home time zone, so it messed everything all up. And I was talking to the developer of the app saying, we need to be able to tell this to use one time zone and not switch when the phone switches. Use GMT or use Pacific time or something like that, so it stays the same and you don't have to think about it when you cross time zones. AJW says he has a Nikon GPS that adds it in the camera, and I don't think Canon, I looked for this, I don't think Canon has one that adds it through the hot shoe. I think that's something you Nikon users have, and I don't think it's something our Canon users have. That's another feature I would hope for in the next generation of cameras, is built-in GPS, so we really don't have to think about this. Okay, enough on that. Let's...
But James Riley is asking about, when we were talking about the features for Lightroom, asking if it already will retain the picture styles on RAW files. And if you use the Canon software for editing, it does. But, I mean, I don't use GPS, so I couldn't confirm that. You do have camera calibration in Lightroom 3 today that matches those camera styles, but I didn't think that data was stored along with the RAW file, because it's different. It's a RAW file.
Well, I think it does put something in the sidecar if you're reading it in the camera, the Canon application. But for example, a good example is if you take a photo and you set it to black and white on the back of the camera and you're shooting in RAW, your live view and what you're seeing shows as black and white, but when you import that into Lightroom, it is no longer black and white. So really, it's just kind of like you get to see the world in black and white, and it's good for composition, but when you come into Lightroom, you still have to process it as a black and white, which was kind of annoying, but then it's like, well, really? Why not have all that information? I mean, that's the essence of a RAW. If you have an application that's reading those picture styles, it's still capturing the full RAW file. A RAW file is all the information. Essentially, all it's doing is it's adding some kind of a predefined preset to it with some settings. So there's not a default where Lightroom will read that, which would be kind of nice, but effectively, you're just adding a preset anyhow. And that's the way I understand it anyway, from what I've messed with it.
Fair enough.
Let's move on from Lightroom and predicting what will happen, because it's a bit hard. That's kind of a deep hole. But AJW says, as someone trying to break into senior portraiture, what group should I be marketing to? Barry, that might be one that you've had a lot of background in. I think we all do some senior portraits, but you've had a lot of background in that. Maybe you can shout out a little on that.
Well, I told AJ and I, we have to have a conversation one of these days, and I can fill in the blanks a little more for him specifically, but here's what I can tell you about senior portraits. It is a moving target that if you ever think you've figured it out, smack yourself upside the head right away, because it doesn't matter what you think you might have figured out, it will be totally irrelevant within months to the next batch of seniors. And what I have found is that what's really frightening right now is that the seniors are more and more getting this attitude of this independence. They want total unique, total creative, totally, they don't want anything like anybody else. Well, the problem is that more and more of these seniors, in a lot of the market research I'm doing and in the interviews I'm doing and in the focus groups we're doing, are telling us that they only want to see photographers work to get an idea of what they might or might not want, but they're all looking for the holy grail of photographers that hasn't done anybody else's pictures. They don't want to go where their friends went, because they want them to be unique. So if we really need, you know, I have, you know, the general market, my general surrounding schools that I'm involved with, we basically have about 2,000 seniors a year that we basically market to that are kind of within our, within, you know, let's say, you know, 7 or 8 miles of our studio. And that, in that group, well, you know, I don't think we quite have 2,000 senior photographers around yet. We might be getting close to that from the sounds of it. But it's a fascinating thing that they want unique. So it's almost like if you shoot a lot of seniors, that isn't necessarily a good thing because, oh, wait. You have to be boutique-y. It's hard to do it. How do you do that? How do you show that you are creative exactly. without showing that you're creative? And as soon as you show that you're creative, well, then, well, everybody's pictures look like that, so now I want something different. So it's really turning into an interesting thing, very different than 15, 20 years ago when the seniors' expectations were much narrower and it was you were really dealing more with the parents at that point.
Well, and not only that, the weird thing is they want all this creative stuff, and yet at some point, sometimes the standard for what's creative and quality is strange too, and it can be, you know, the photos can be crud, but to them they're phenomenal, which
right.
is, so yeah, it's a struggle. And Barry, you're having some issues with your mic, so make sure you don't have any other internet stuff going on or anything. You're kind of cutting out here and there, so you can check that out. But Dennis, you do seniors too, and do you have any input on this?
Not anymore that Barry just added. I honestly do very few seniors. I don't even market to that
right.
part of the market. Mostly stick with weddings and then the families right now.
Well, and see, I'm low volume because I have all these projects, and you know, I've talked about this before. I'm forging forward with the higher end wall portraits and stuff, and experimenting with marketing, and because I can, because I have my fingers in a lot of fires, and it keeps me busy. So I don't do a real high volume because of that, but basically I put my senior portraits to that high-end wall portrait stuff, and I've essentially worked out my packages so everybody books a package that's around $1,000 right from the start, and it comes with enough credit for a wall portrait and stuff like that. So I've funneled it into getting people to book what I want to sell versus just being willing to work for a pittance just to get the job. And it just depends on where you want to be as far as volume and stuff like that. It's tough. There, in terms of marketing, because that's AWJ, that's what you asked actually from the start was, who should you be marketing to? There are a lot of schools and stuff have senior fairs that you can go to, and usually they're not real expensive. You can set up a little booth. You can, of course, have a website. One advantage is to get into some SEO stuff for your website, because usually the competition for senior portraits in your city is going to be less than, say, wedding photography in the nearest big city that you want to market to. The cool thing about seniors is it's a client base that's regenerated every year, and if you're focusing on that and building that market, you can do really well with it. There's also people that focus on direct mail. I've never done great with direct mail, but I know people that do good with direct mail because they're consistent with it and it's a major part of their marketing. It seems like the person I have in mind that does really well with direct mail is someone who's incredibly consistent. I mean, they literally have a schedule months in advance and they're doing direct mailings like every month, sometimes a couple a month. They send out a mailing, then they send out a reminder for that mailing. So it's a presence. It's not like, oh, I bought a mailing list and I'm just going to send it out once and hope that I get a bunch of jobs from it, because I've done that before and it doesn't work. And Facebook ads. I haven't had very good luck with Facebook ads as a photographer. Honestly, I haven't had good luck with Facebook ads for anything. For my sim effects and stuff, a little bit. I can get a few fans to the page because there's relevance. But in terms of hiring a photographer, a lot of the speakers and stuff say, oh, yeah, you do Facebook ads and they're cheap. Well, first of all, they're not that cheap. You might be paying $1 per click. And it seems to me because of the quality of Facebook ads, it's kind of associated with junk and teeth whitening.
I often say that I think the only people that Facebook ads are working for is Facebook.
Yeah, I think to a large degree that's so. And let's actually put AJW Studios on the call here. I'm going to unmute
you. Yeah.
And we'll get a little bit of listener interaction. And if any of you others want to call in, absolutely get logged in so we can add you into this, because that's what this is all about. So AWJ, no, hang on a second. I'm working to there you go. Are you there?
Hello?
There you are. Hey, welcome.
Hey,
Andrew.
How are you guys?
You are on Pro Photo Show.
There we go.
Oh, come on. Sound excited at least.
I know.
He's super excited.
Okay. I bet. Go ahead, buddy.
This is exciting. I love it.
No, but, like, I'm just going to harp on the Facebook ads. I had received a coupon from Facebook to try out their ad system, and it ran for about a month, and I only got, like, 12 clicks, and to get those 12 clicks, they came all within the last 3 days, because at the last 3 days, they started running my ad nonstop just to get some clicks.
Right.
It was a complete gimmick, and I was completely horrified by how bad Facebook did to get anything out of it.
Yeah, and on the positive note, I don't want to be completely negative to it. I totally know what you mean, and I've experimented with my photography side quite a bit, actually, and with my software that I sell, which admittedly is a more, you know, instant reaction kind of thing. Go to the website, become a fan of the page. So that part works a little better, although it's still hard to really track it and show that it's really working well. But on the upside, Facebook is cool because you can target so well. I mean, you can target age groups, and part of it is finessing what you want to do with it. And you can target age groups and fans of certain groups and pages and all this kind of stuff. So the targeting is really cool, and you can really narrow down who you want to market to, which means that you're not wasting money on people that are non-relevant. I think there are ways to use Facebook in a good way. I'm not sure if it's really ideal for photographers because, again, we're coming back to the fact that the quality of ads, you know, people don't usually give them that much credibility, I guess I would say. And, you know, it could be the reason that you weren't getting many clicks, Andrew, is that you had the bid wasn't high enough per click. Other people were taking them instead of you, kind of thing.
I had the bid set up to like a dollar or something, where it tops out at a dollar or something. But all of the clicks came in under like 30 cents. So
okay.
I don't think that was the problem. And I think what it was, I was targeting more the high school seniors, and there's such a generation gap that, you know, most of them associate all those ads with junk. And now that I look at the ads that I have on that side there, they are all junk. And why would I ever click on any one of them? Now,
yeah.
If I targeted parents a little bit more, that might change a little bit, but most of the parents aren't on enough to make it worthwhile.
The truth is, when you're selling a high-end product and your ad is shown next to something that borders on a scam, it's hard to look very reputable. That's kind of my take. Not that there's no way to use Facebook as a photographer, and I'm sure in some areas Facebook ads are relevant, but I haven't found the secret to it. So if somebody does, they are welcome to shout out.
Well, I can tell you that I have benefited significantly from Facebook and I've never done a Facebook ad. We are using our Facebook page. The biggest thing we're doing right is we're running these monthly senior portrait type Facebook contests, and we're being pretty careful on how we word it and what we say. That is driving people to our site. That is driving likes. It is driving fans, and it's getting noticed. And we started it, I think, September was our first monthly contest, and it's really kind of beginning to take a bit of a life of its own, and to the point now where I've actually had a few kids ask me, who are juniors right now, what will it take for me to get in one of your Facebook contests next year?
Nice. Well, and yeah, you and Dennis have both been doing some of this stuff, and it seems to be really effective, and maybe, Dennis, you should talk about this too. I think what this comes back to, Barry, is Facebook is a social place. That's the entire
Correct.
Idea. And I always see companies, and I see this all the time with people's pages or places I'm working with. I'll say start a page, and their page is nothing but an ad. You know, come in, check out our latest specials. And the next day it says, come in and check out our latest specials. And the next day it says, we had a ton of people last night. Really awesome. You know, there's no interaction. People want to interact. And I have the page that I've done the best with and built the best, it has 3,500 fans or something right now, is my SimFX page. And I promote it pretty heavily because, you know, it makes me money. But what goes on with that page is interaction. I talk about photography. It's not a constant ad for my latest product or my latest workshop. And yes, I definitely promote those on there. But that's probably a quarter of it. The rest is, you know, I might post a photo and talk about how I make it, or I might pose a question. And it may not be relevant to everybody, but I'm carrying on a conversation and I'm making it social. And that's what you're doing with these contests and stuff like that. You're getting people involved, and that's really the way to do on to make things work well on Facebook. That, the page is really powerful there, and I think that,
well,
that making it social is huge.
We had, and I just want to share this story quick. It's from our monthly winner that just won this, well, yesterday the contest ended. Just find Picture Place Photography on Facebook. Look at our monthly contest. We had our pictures all queued up for this month's contest, and we get a call out of the blue from a lady who says she needs another 8x10 of her son, but she's in a big hurry and she needs it in 2 days for his funeral. And we're like, you
wow.
got to be kidding me. Well, and it turns out that it was one of the kids we had dialed up for this contest. It's, he was a boxer. He did not die of a boxing-related injury, though he was at the boxing club when he first had his little aneurysm or whatever. And so I, right away, you know, with, you know, sensitivity, obviously, gee, you know, we're so sorry to hear about that. We obviously provided the print. We never charge people for those kinds of things and are happy to kind of provide that. But
sure.
We said, you know, we did have Charlie's picture, you know, lined up for this month's contest, but, you know, in deference, we'll let you make the call whether or not you want that picture run in the contest. And she goes, oh, that would be wonderful. And he did win the contest. It was a neck-and-neck race. We had another kid with a pretty sweet shot. We did all boys for the first time this month, and I was very glad to see that he squeaked out in the end and won by 3 votes. And
nice.
we put those monthly winners up at the movie, at the local movie theater, and then, you know, give them a copy of the wall portrait we put up. But it was, you know, kind of a gut-wrenching story, and it's a sweet shot. And then the mom, you know, just said that picture was, you know, it was huge for him. It was his favorite picture in the hospital in the last 2 weeks of his life. That was the picture next to his bedside that got, you know, gave him a lot of comfort. So, you know,
right.
I guess in the end of it all, we still are creating images that at times, frankly, can have a pretty big impact on people's lives and families, and we can't lose sight of that, because sometimes we get so caught up about how much to sell an 8x10 for, we forget that when we're dealing with photographs of people anyway in their lives, that there's some pretty significant things that go on.
Well, and that's a good point, because it's something that we don't think about a lot, but it's something that at the Wall Portrait Conference they talk about, because they're dealing with families and stuff a lot, and there's people there that have these stories of families that they postponed or this or that, and somebody died in the family, and it, you know, a portrait can have some real value. Andrew, I'm gonna mute you because to avoid extra sound going on, and if you want to add any more, feel free to raise your hand again. But thanks for jumping in there. There's some weird sound going on. I'm not sure, I'm trying to figure out where it's coming from.
I think it sounds like Barry's playing the bongos.
Somebody have a cell phone near the computer? That's what it sounds like. Somebody has their phone too close to the system. It sounds like it's gone away now. Anyway, Dennis, you've been doing a lot of this Facebook stuff too. Do you have any insight? Would you give like the 67-second roundup of maybe a few tips of what you're doing with this Facebook stuff lately? Because I know you're doing pretty well with it too.
Well, I'll give a brief overview of what I did, and it seemed to work pretty well, but I would really, really like to hear from Carrie, because I know that Carrie has had a few guests on that have talked about Facebook and social media, and
awesome.
Carrie has also done some different things. I'm friends with him on Facebook, and I've noticed him really making an effort to try to keep, you know, personal, business, and that just is very interesting to me, because I basically do what he's trying not to do right now. I would actually like to give up my turn just to hear Carrie's side of the story, if that's cool.
Go for it. Yeah, Carrie, what do you have to say?
That. Thank you for noticing, I guess.
Yeah.
this has been an interesting exercise that I've been working on, and it wasn't feasible a couple months ago to have a business page that had the functionality that you needed. You couldn't tag people, you couldn't get notifications from it, and I hated the fact that I had my business page and I had no idea if anyone ever commented on it. I'd have to go and check it every day. And so recently, with the help of Kirsten Wright, who was a guest on my podcast recently, and we had her at our local photography show here to talk about branding and image and social things, and she really was encouraging me to separate those two and have my personal stuff and my business stuff separated. And so I have been making a concerted effort to build my Facebook page, the facebook.com/GarrisonPhotography, into what it, that's what it should be. That is my business contacts. My personal profile should be for my friends and family. And about once a week, I post and I say, please, everybody, go like my page over there. And that's where you're going to see the new images and the photography-related stuff. If you want the pictures of my dogs, you know, and the stupid stuff that I do, that's my personal profile. But if you want to follow my photography work, follow my page. And for me, that's kind of liberating in a sense, because as I start trying to prune down the personal profile where I know that I could say something stupid without the world knowing about it, that's kind of nice, you know, where, okay, my professional side is my professional side, and then I want to keep it that way. It's not that I'm trying to be phony or anything. It's just there's things that you do in a public forum, and there's things that you do in a more private forum, and they don't always gel, I guess would be the way to put it. And so that's what I have been trying to do, and Dennis is right. And I think it's working. I think I'm trying to do that. And for the people who don't really care about my daily dribble stuff to my friends and family, unfriend me and just like my page. And I can still have contact with you. You can still follow me. I can still respond to you. You can still comment on my stuff. And to me, that's a much better way of dealing with it.
And something I'll throw in that a feature that Facebook added that I actually like is that I have the option to go to my Picture Place Photography Facebook page, and then I can interact on Facebook as Picture Place Photography as opposed to just as me. And that's right. A fairly recent feature that I don't think a lot of people are necessarily harnessing that, because I've tried hard to maintain that separation of my page and the studio page. So yeah, it's good stuff, and I don't know, it's a challenge.
And Northern Horse is correct. It actually, having your business being promoted on a profile page is against their user agreement, and they have shut some people down for it. I believe they are going to really start cracking down on it now that the pages have the functions that we've needed for a long time, and they were probably a little more lenient on that before, but I have heard of people being shut down for it. So protect yourself. Your personal profile is exactly that. It's your personal profile. Your business page is your business page.
Well, and just to clarify a couple things, Kerry, you can have a personal profile and mention things in your business, or you can have friends that are colleagues or something like that. Where you run into issues is if you have a personal profile that's actually a Facebook profile, and then a business, say, Signed Photography, that's also a Facebook profile versus a page. And
we're seeing a lot of, and if you look at, you probably have this on a lot of the friends on Facebook, it will be Joe Smith Photography.
Right.
Personal profile.
Now, just to clarify, unless this has changed in a couple months, in the past couple months, because I've looked into this pretty heavily, you can have a Facebook profile that is your business, but you can't have both. So, which is kind of a weird thing to do. But unless they've changed it just in this last month or two, you can have a Facebook profile, as in friending people, that is Joe Smith Photography, but you can't also have a Facebook profile for Joe Smith. But bottom line is, I think if you're a business, you should be a page. When I get a friend request from a business, it feels kind of spammy to me, and I'm like, you guys really don't know what you're doing, do you?
Right.
A little bit of a plug for Pro Photo Show. I'm going to link this in the show notes. There's an article on Pro Photo Show that basically has managing Facebook pages and basically everything I've learned looking into terms and rules and things you can do and can't do, but also tips for how to change things on Facebook. It's been updated for the new pages that came out recently, and it's an article on managing the power of Facebook pages. I'll link it in the show notes, but I've also put it here in the chat room. Good tips here from Kerry and Barry and stuff like that. Now, Kerry, Barry, I kind of like the way that rhymes, Kerry and Barry. Gary and Barry and Dennis, do you guys have you guys noticed with the new pages that things have changed? And it seems to me that the interaction in some level is less. It seems like they're metering things differently because by default, there things are kind of rising to the top that are getting attention. So it almost seems like if you post something to a page and then it doesn't get immediate attention and interaction from people, it kind of gets shuffled to the bottom. And I've actually posted things. For example, if I post something to SimeFX, it says how many – a day later, it says how many impressions that post has got, how many people have seen that. So if I post something that gets good interaction, it might say this has got 5,000 impressions. But occasionally I'll post something else, and it'll say this has got 20 impressions. And the ones that have less impressions are the ones that maybe didn't get a lot of interaction or likes or something like that. And I'm still trying to figure out how their algorithm works in terms of, you know, getting things seen. But the general interaction on pages, to me, since the update seems to be down because I think a lot of people aren't seeing things.
I think you're right, Gavin. I've noticed, and even in my own, just when I go to the timeline, it always defaults back to most popular. And I don't want most popular. I want most recent. But there, I can't find a preference to say, leave it on most recent.
Right. Well, now you can change that now. If you go to your page, there's now, when it first came out, there wasn't. But now there is a button that you can click most recent, and it should allow you to switch it over. Because
it doesn't keep that setting.
It does for me. I'm not sure why it does for you. It's actually a check, but it's actually a drop down at the very top, just under the photo icons, and it'll say I'll click the drop down and say most recent, and it stays that way for me. But I'm not sure why it's not for you.
Every once in a while, I'll go back in, and it'll be back on top news.
Interesting.
And I have to click it, and it may stay for a couple days. It's kind of strange.
It is very strange.
Yeah. But I guess the bigger concern with me is just the fact that the interaction was down, and I feel like less people are seeing these things I'm posted. So I've been trying to experiment and see, you know, okay, if I make something that gets more interaction, if I pose it as a question, does it go up in terms of impressions? And it's almost like it's randomized. I mean, I'll post something that'll get hardly any impressions, and then I'll post something else that'll get a lot. And it's a little frustrating because I might post an event or something like that, and for whatever reason, that one doesn't get noticed, and yet something else I post gets noticed all kinds of times. So, Barry, you were saying something.
No, I was just going to say that I don't care if you've had any experience with this, but just about a month ago, I had read an article or a blog or something I ran across about how people are starting to create Facebook pages with names that are very similar to various business pages to try and kind of snipe in and do whatever. Well, here, just this week, I just was going to, I had to run over to my picture place, Facebook page. So I pop into the little thing and start typing. And then I see this, mine says picture place photography with spaces between the words. All of a sudden now there's a page that's popped up from California that's pictureplacephotography.com is what their Facebook page name is.
Right.
And all of a sudden, so now it's like, wait a minute, now I click on this page, and it's some place in Jackson, California with one person liking it. So it's brand new, and it's like, wait a minute, that's, talk about confusing. And here I had just read this, so, you know, it's like, that's the problem. We can't control, people can just sit there and make up names, so I could, I could spell SimeFX a little differently, make my own SimeFX Facebook page, and start sniping off presets. That's not a bad idea, come to think of it.
Well, the problem we have here, though, is it used to be, in the old days, you know, if you had a place called Picture Place Photography, and it might be in another state, and there might be another business named the same thing, but you'd never really notice. Now that we're on Facebook, it's like this global arena. And I have to say, having the name Syme, there's not a lot of photographers out there named Syme, so that's been an asset to me because you can pretty much always find Gavin Syme if you're searching for him because there's just not that many Gavin Symes out there doing photos. So,
there's not that many Gavin Symes, thankfully.
No, I don't know if I actually don't know of any other Gavin Symes in the world for that matter, so that makes it very convenient for me. So you could change your last name to something crazy like Epistemological Dualism or something like that.
Right.
And which might that's a bad website name. Now we're getting on that topic. Anyway, let's move off the Facebook page and on this social network, Northern Horse wants to talk a little bit about
Twitter.
And honestly, this seems to be the general consensus lately. It seems like Facebook is becoming more valuable in terms of marketing than Twitter is. I get more interactions on Facebook. I think maybe because people see the interactions. If I pose a question, people see the thread with people talking on it, and you get a conversation going. It's more social. I use Twitter, and most of the things you see on my Facebook personal profile come from Twitter, because I'll just tweet it, and then it goes to both. But I'm definitely noticing the interaction on Twitter is even less than Facebook.
I think what I've seen, especially in the photography industry, is that Twitter is a peer-to-peer communication, and Facebook is you to your client base. So a lot of photographers are on Twitter, and we chat back and forth, and we see what each other is doing, but I don't see potential clients on
right.
Twitter.
Right.
Gavin, I'll hop in on Twitter just real quick. Dennis and I just last week were at a kind of a wedding panel night where there was a panel of brides, and the question specifically was posed to them about Twitter and Facebook, and it was pretty much none of them were on Twitter for anything having to do with their wedding, and they could care less about vendors on Twitter.
But it was the exact opposite for Facebook, though.
They lived on Facebook.
If we're done on that, there was a whole thread in the chat about Square Up. Anyone else besides me using Square Up?
No, I'm not familiar with Square Up.
But Square Up is for credit card processing. You sign up, you get this little dongle that plugs into the headphone jack on your iPhone, iPad, or Android phone, and you get an associated app with it. You can swipe a credit card and do your transactions right there on the spot. If you key in the credit card information, the fee is 3.75% plus 15 cents. If you swipe a card, it's 2.75%. And that's significantly better than 5% on PayPal. So I've completely switched off of PayPal to using Square Up because it's convenient, it's fast, especially when I'm at a trade show selling my lighting products. Swipe, 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 and
right.
Get money within 36 hours. Now, there was the part of the thread in there was issues, people's concerns about the $1,000 a week limit that they have. And the way that actually works is when you initially sign up, what they'll tell you is if you do more than $1,000 in any 7-day period, they hold the amount over $1,000 for 30 days in order to protect them from fraud and back charges and things. The very first thing you want to do is tie it to your bank account. That gives you a level of legitimacy there. And you want to make sure that you are a legitimate business and you have all those things in place. But they've just changed it. What they were doing is you would call them, you'd go through this process, and they would up that limit. Now they have this algorithm that just runs automatically, and as you do more and more transactions based on your chargeback rate and stuff, they will automatically increase that limit. And I've only been using it for 3 weeks, and I haven't hit a limit yet. And I've done well over $1,000 in 1 week, and they did $1,000 the first day, and they put through another $400 a few days later. So I haven't really been affected by this $1,000 per 7-day limit so far. I mean, I haven't tried to do a $5,000 order yet, but
right.
Doing 1,000 here, 1,000 there, it just hasn't been a big deal. And the ease of use, the low cost of the transaction versus PayPal or some of the other merchant services, there's no sign-up fee, there's no monthly fee, it's just that transaction fee. It's an excellent way of being able to...
Yeah, it sounds like a cool solution. It's a cool solution for a lot of people. Now, just to clarify, I don't pay 5% on PayPal. I pay about the same as you're talking about. I pay 2.5 to 3-ish percent plus like the 20 cents or whatever like that. But I also have a PayPal... What's that?
Are you using the virtual terminal?
Yes, I have a PayPal Pro account, which does cost me $30 a month.
So there's $30 a month. And
right.
So there is no monthly fee and all that.
That's awesome.
With it. So,
well, so for most people, that sounds quite a bit better. For me, I have to have, you know, I sell the online stuff, and I have to have the card integration and all that kind of stuff, and it has to work. I'm actually not a fan of PayPal because I feel like they rip me off sometimes in terms of, well, this, we could get into this whole thing about credit card companies and the way that you take the hit if they take a fraud card. I think that's kind of nuts. But PayPal, I'm not a fan of their service or that sort of thing. I don't really like them, but I just wanted to shout out about
the right. Because if Square Up eventually offers the ability to do the online transactions and connection with our eJunkie accounts and things like that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I'll certainly look at it. Of course, I still have to use PayPal for that because it's an online transaction. I really can't get around that yet. But those face-to-face ones where I can get it down to $275, and I'm either selling hard products like my lighting gear, I'm taking a deposit from somebody. And
right.
If you're the type of person who hits that last payment on the evening of the wedding, you can turn on tips. So you hand it to them with the amount, and there's a little key that says add a tip amount. So that's kind of a nice little touch, too.
Yeah, that's cool. I always get my wedding payments before the day of. But no, in fact, now that you bring this up, I think I have a friend that has this, and it is pretty cool. I've heard really good things about it. And the swiping thing and all that kind of stuff. Because PayPal does have a virtual terminal, but it's not the best if you're really trying to crank things through. So, and then Andrew mentioned Google Checkout. I actually have a Google Checkout account as kind of a fallback because, you know, there's horror stories about suddenly PayPal banning you or whatever. So I actually have a fallback account on Google Checkout that I could switch to. But the truth is, and I looked into this, Google Checkout is bad too in terms of taking care of the merchant. And this is common across the credit card industry. For example, if somebody takes a card, goes to my website and buys my software, they can really take advantage of the system. And if there's a dispute or something like that, PayPal and most of these places really don't back you up very well. They don't back up the merchants at all. In fact, a lot of times they'll decide in your favor, even if it's them that took a fraudulent card. And they will not only take the money back from you, they'll charge you a fee. And to me, it's just nuts. I mean, here, I'm paying you 3%. You are responsible to make sure this card goes through. And it's just the way, I can't imagine when the credit card world started, anybody would have taken them if it was that way. It's like we've become so dependent on them that they've gradually worked into that. And they will just fleece you in terms of, you know, they don't take the risk for anything. They'll just take the money back from you. You know, you could have sold somebody a $10,000 camera and legitimately taking the card, and they might take the money back if you decide, you know, the same with PayPal, the same with Google Checkout, really, from what I've seen, the same with every credit card company. So that's a real frustration with me, too, but I don't know. What do you do?
Yeah, this is one thing with Square, and I was too busy because I was doing it by myself at the last show, but when you do that transaction, you can actually take a photo. So
that's
what
cool.
I was thinking about doing is because I'm handing them products, so
right.
I should never have a chargeback or anything. But I was thinking of, okay, let me get your picture, click, and attach it to the transaction. You dispute
right.
it. I'm going to say, look, here's a picture of you holding the product.
Yeah, yeah. That might be a good idea. Well, and a physical product, and if you're shipping it and you have a tracking number, download products are really bad. They almost never side with you on a download product. On a physical product, it is easier, but you can still get taken. I lost the first camera I sold, my 10D, when I got the 20D or the 30D or something, I sold a 10D on eBay, and it was out of country. It was Thailand or something, and I guess I was an eBay noob, but we processed it directly over a credit card machine that my parents' business had, and I ended up losing it. It was totally a scam. They used a fraudulent card. They took all the money back, and I had no camera, and I was out of luck. So anyway.
Oh, yeah. I shipped a product to someone, and when they disputed it, they had a picture of the box that I sent full of bricks.
Wow. That's
Kerry,
yeah,
you shouldn't have done that, Kerry.
Yeah, same on you.
No, Barry, what he's saying is that somebody else put bricks in there is what he's saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
PayPal does have good reporting in terms. I have a lot of transactions with my software and stuff, and I can very easily go through and make quarterly statements and stuff like that by downloading those spreadsheets. And I don't know if Square does that or not. I suppose that's not too rare of a feature, but their reporting does work pretty well.
They have. And, you can download everything as a CSV file, and there's a question
that's good.
Do they issue you a 1099? And I don't see why they would issue you a 1099. They're not paying you.
Yeah, you have. They're just a merchant, so you're just another. They're not the merchant; they're the processor. So you just get your listings of all your money. But yes, Guest 36 says I prefer cash, and I would plus one of that. I don't encourage people to give me a credit card. I mean, the amount of money that we're giving to credit card companies, and I feel like there's more and more businesses that are on the storefront businesses that are charging extra or refusing to take credit cards because people are getting tired of getting taken by the credit card companies and the fees add up and all that kind of stuff. So
when I was doing the recent shows, I had a, here's your cash price and here's the credit card price.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't
significant, but I got to cover those fees too.
Well, it becomes significant if somebody's paying you for a $5,000 wedding. And at this point, make a difference. I'll take the card. I don't charge extra because I'm doing high end. I don't want to be nickel and diming people, but it definitely takes a hit. Anyway, somebody mentioned a little while back, I can't remember, I saw this question come up, and Guest 34. And I don't want to get on this whole rant. Oh, it's Steve. Hi, Steve. And he wanted to know what's up with the issues of the 5D Mark II lens falling off. I'm not gonna
Are you gonna open
a huge rant? I'm really not. He asked, so I'm gonna mention
it's
it.
Only Gavin.
Not actually. There's comments weekly now of people that are dropping and breaking very expensive lenses. They keep coming in more and more. I think there's somewhere around 150 comments on this post, and I will link this in the show notes. And if you want to see the updates, I haven't done an update in a little while. I won't go into a big rant other than saying that the problem is there. Canon has not addressed it, and yes, lenses are falling off. But admittedly, I haven't had one happen in a while because I'm very aware of it. So if you're really paying attention, a lot of times you can save yourself. But just, I'm not going to say don't buy a 5D Mark II. I will say if I was starting from scratch right now, I would probably go with Nikon over Canon because of the fact that they're ignoring this issue. But I won't say if you're a Canon user, don't get a 5D Mark II. Just be careful. Be aware of it. And by all means, raise your voice if anything happens because Canon needs to be aware of this. Not everybody deals with it. That's the problem. It's a small number of people comparatively to how many people own it. It's relevant to how you hold the camera and stuff like that. But, yeah, we'll go on. I could rant about it. It makes me angry, but read the post. So check in the show notes or the link here in the chat room. Okay, let's jump in. Does anybody have another question or anybody want to call in? We're actually about coming to the end time here. We've been going for a while. We're going to wrap up here soon. If we want to get any last minute questions, let's jump in. Or if any of you panelists want to jump in and say anything, let's do that too. This has been really fun. So does anybody have anything? If not, we will go into picks of the week and stuff like that. I would be glad to take another caller here, though, if somebody wants to jump in. Actually, the chat room has been really lively here. There's been, I don't know, got to be 20 or 30 people throughout this show have been on here, and that's really cool. So that's been a lot of fun. Let's go into some picks of the week and talk about a couple of cool gadgets, guys, and we'll wrap up on a note of cool gadgets, I guess. So who wants to go first?
I'll go. That's fine.
Yeah, go for it. Carrie, go ahead.
Okay. Expo Imaging had a product announcement this week, the Rogue Grid, and I love my flash benders. They're one of my favorite modifiers, so I'm kind of jazzed to see this Rogue Grid when it comes out. It's a spot grid that just attaches to your speed light, and since that's mostly all I use anymore, speed light, this is something I'm looking forward to because I do love my flash benders. But that's coming. It's not out yet. So if I want to talk about something that's out, I've been playing with the Sigma 8-16mm F4 to 5.6 DC HSM. And
wow.
For a crop sensor design lens at 8mm, it's crazy. And it's lenticular, so lines stay straight. It just really exaggerates the distance between the camera and the center thing. So you can make a very tiny room look really, really big. You know, make a backyard look really big. it has a unique effect for architecture and real estate type things. Not so great for people, but you know, if they're dead center, it's not so bad. You can get some really interesting effects with it. It's
excellent.
Not that expensive. The really sharp, it's super fast, and it's just a fun lens. It's not going to be your go-to lens. It's not going to be your portrait lens. It's going to be one of those specialty lenses that you pull out once in a while.
Awesome. Now, this is, what's the abbreviated form of the name of this lens so I can find it for show notes?
Sigma 8-16 DC 8-10. Oh, why don't I post in it? I've got a review that I've done on it. So.
Oh, awesome. Okay, we can link that too. Super. I will copy that for the show notes. Excellent. Okay. Dennis, what do you got for us on the picks of the week?
Absolutely nothing.
Okay, Dennis, we're coming back to you in about 60 seconds. Come up with something.
I got nothing.
Awesome.
Did I pick Lightroom 3? iPhone 4? The first iPad? I got nothing.
You better start checking your Twitter feeds for something awesome because we're coming back to you.
But I haven't used it. Come back to me at the next roundtable. I will blow your minds away with a game.
You better.
Talk like, about how awesome black belt lighting products are, Dennis.
Gary, you need to just put a box of that stuff together, send it toward Minnesota. Dennis and I will use it, we'll test it, we'll write about it, we'll love you to death.
And then we'll send it back with a box full of bricks.
Plus five.
Barry, what do you got for us?
I'm going to bring up the Nikon P7000 that Dennis and I both have. We've had these cameras for a few months now, and the more I'm using it, the more I'm enjoying it. The quality of the raw files is superb. It is darn near as good as the Leica X1. Very, very close. It's not a very expensive camera, but it's very, very flexible. I am just having a ball with that camera, as is my little friend Dennis.
Excellent. That's cool. A good compact is always a good thing. You know how fanatical I am about good compacts. I buy a new one every year. Speaking of which, little shout out. I do have an E-PL1 from Olympus for sale with the pancake lens. So if anybody's interested.
That's not a shout out. That's a commercial, Gavin.
I know.
But it's your show, so you can do whatever you want.
It's different, Dennis. It's a classified. Okay. Anyway, yes, because I want to try the X100, not because it's a bad cam. All right, picks of the week. My picks of the week is one I want to throw out there is On1 Perfect Resize from On1 Software. This is a cool app. When CS5 came, the up conversion, and just to clarify for the listening audience who's not done a lot of large printing, you know, if you have a 5,000 pixel file and you want to print it at 50 inches, and I just recently did an article about resolution on Pro Photo Show that goes into all this, but what it does, it increases the resolution, it does what they call interpolation, and basically fills in the gaps between pixels, kind of guessing at what it thinks should be there. It is not the same as having 100 megapixel camera, but it does help increase the quality if you're printing really, really high so that you're not printing an image that's 50 DPI. You know, you can crank it up for those large prints. And built in CS5 is pretty good, but then Perfect Resize came out after CS5 did. It was previously called Genuine Fractals, and the new version of Perfect Resize actually trumped CS5 once again, in my opinion, and it's really good plug-in. Couple hundred dollars, I think, and it's just great for resizing those images. That's what it's for, is for interpolated images, and the idea is that it does a little better job than the built-in Photoshop. So if you really want that quality, which I've been pretty passionate about lately, is getting the best I possibly can, I think that's a really good application. And I'll mention, too, we've had an ongoing affiliate deal with them because we've talked about their products in the past. Code PRPHTPC will save you 15% on that product. So I'll throw that in there too. And you can also find that on the deals page on the show. Now, on the analog side of a physical product, I want to mention this little guy here, and I'll put it in the chat room. It's a little case for a hard drive, and it's a pretty cool little gizmo. It is the Mini Pro 2.5-inch FireWire 800, 400, and USB external hard drive enclosure. Essentially, this is a portable hard drive, but it's a metal case. You buy it for about $65, and you can put any SATA 2.5-inch laptop hard drive you want. So you buy the case, and then you buy a hard drive, and then when you want to upgrade it, to a bigger hard drive. You just put a new hard drive in. The awesome thing is it's self-powered, it's compact, it's very sturdy. This thing's like made very solidly in out of aluminum. And the cool thing is it has all these connection types. It has FireWire 800, 400, and USB. I use mine in FireWire 800, which is the fastest of the three, but it's very versatile because you can plug it into almost anything. So really like this gizmo, and it's been a good case. That's what I use for my portable hard drive these days, and it's been working really well. And with that, let's see if we have anything else. I'm just kind of checking the chat room out here and making sure I'm not missing anything. Andrew mentioned the Cowboy Studio triggers, which we've talked about in the past. They were a pick of the week in the past. And the Cowboy Studio remote triggers for flashes. This is like a flash triggering setup. In any case, the Cowboy Studio remote triggers, they're nothing fancy. They're not super well made. I have had one break, but they're like $20 and they work. They're not ETTL like the fancy Pocket Wizards or the Radio Poppers, which is what I use. But I bought a set of them to try them, and they do work, and they're pretty cool, and they're really cheap.
And Gary, you sell some that are similar to that, right?
Gary, yeah, what's the deal with
Black Belt Lighting products? Because of Camera Dojo, people had always asked me, where do I buy product? Where do I buy this stuff? And I used to refer to Amazon or Cowboy Studio or some of these other places, and some of the places that I'd referred to in the past had gone out of business, and finally I just bit the bullet and decided to start bringing this stuff in myself and brought it out under the name Black Belt Lighting and Black Belt Dojo. You see there's kind of a tie in there. So,
right. Exactly.
It's the same triggers that they sell on there. They're manual. They work up to about 90 feet and they work great. I mean, I've sold hundreds of them in the last couple months and people love them. With the speed, I've got the speed light, the YN560 speed light for about $100. Awesome speed light, same power as a 580EX, but it's just manual, but it's got optical, PC sync, and hot shoe. So I just tried to come up with a line of affordable lighting products for people that weren't the bottom of the barrel. They're not high-end. They're just kind of in that mid-range of quality, but I made them as affordable as possible.
Excellent, excellent. Just to clarify, what you're doing with this, Kerry, is you're putting packages of lighting stuff that you found works good together and putting those together for Black Belt Lighting is the concept here.
That's correct, yeah.
Gotcha. I will link that in the show notes as well for you listeners. Bottom line is on those cowboy triggers, I use the Radio Poppers and really enjoying those. Really cool because they have a lot of range. I get like 600 feet out of them, but it's also like $500. So the cool thing about those cowboy triggers, Kerry, is like there's no excuse not to be doing some creative lighting. Pick a set of those up, and maybe later you'll want a better one, but grab them and start doing some things.
Well, I think it's the same with a lot of stuff. How many of us are shooting our cameras in manual mode? Pretty much all of us. So why aren't we understanding how to shoot flash in manual mode?
Oh, we absolutely should. I mean, at a wedding, a lot of times I like having the ETTL, but definitely should be working with that.
If you want that light to be consistent across every single shot, ETTL is not going to do it.
Right, exactly.
It's going to vary a little bit because of reflections and things. And manual isn't as hard as people think that it is.
And that's what I'm trying
to teach people.
Yeah, it's important. Hey, I want to shout out to my wife, who's actually guest 40 here in the chat room, and my baby girl and my boy at home. They are listening at home, and I see her in there. I just noticed that she's in there. So, hello, Sandra. Sandra is who you hear at the beginning of the show, that lovely voice in the intro, and it replaced that early, really bad intro that people hated, where I was like making, you know, doing all these weird effects with my voice, and there was like shutter clicks and stuff like that. Sandra is in place of that now, and it's much better. So any of you guys have anything else to say? I think we're pretty much good. Let's give shout-out. Where can they find you all at? And we'll wrap this up.
Pictureplace.com. There it is.
Pictureplace.com for Barry. Dennis, you are at DZPix.com. I know that one. Kerry
Garrison. That is so easy to remember, isn't it?
I know.
It's so easy.
Yeah.
Well, I stepped on Kerry's.
Sorry. Kerry.
Yeah, I'm at kerrygarrison.com, cameradojo.com. You heard Black Belt Lighting products there, blackbeltlighting.com. We've got a workshop coming up in June here in Southern California. And got one little piece of news. I'm going to be the author of the new Canon Speedlight Digital Field Guide from Wiley Publishing 3rd Edition. So I'm working on that project too.
Awesome. Very nice. Very cool. Congratulations. That sounds like a fun project that will be a lot of work.
Yeah.
But writing is fun and very keeps you busy. Kerry, they can find you on Twitter as well. Did you mention your Twitter?
Twitter.com/Kerry Garrison and Facebook.com/Garrison.
Great. And Dennis, you are at DZ Picks on Twitter, I believe, right?
Yep. Keep the brand all together. And I am also
or is that the personal profile or your business page?
On Twitter?
Yeah.
Oh, we didn't talk about that. I don't know. DZ Picks,
excellent. And Barry, I think you have a Twitter account now too. Shout that out. We need to get you a couple followers.
Yeah, I know. F-stop 95.
F-stop 95. And of course you can find me guys at Gavin Syme on Twitter, and gosh, I have so many pages and sites and stuff. If you go to SimeStudios.com, you can find me there, SEIMStudios.com. There's links to all my website. I just made a new site for my portraits, which is entirely flash free. I'm still doing some refinement, but all the galleries and everything, no flash on that site at all. And that's kind of been it's a WordPress site, and I've been playing with that and having fun with it. So you can check it out. But all that is at SimeStudios.com, including links to Facebook pages and stuff like that. And of course, my software and goodies and workshops, SimeEffects.com. And thank you all for being here. And I think that's about it. We're going to wrap this up for this time. This has been the first Pro Photo Show Live. I know I've been stumbling along. I'm trying to get used to watching chat rooms and making sure everything's on track here. So I was probably a little less professional than usual. Well, maybe not.
No, nope, right on.
I think we will do this again. This was a lot of fun. I don't plan on doing this every time, but we'll see how the quality of the recording comes out and how many hours I have to spend editing and get it all tidied up. But definitely something, if you guys are enjoying it, that we'll plan on doing again in the future if people want to. Yeah, thanks for joining us, Terry, Barry, and Dennis. And you can find the show notes at profotoshow.com as well as the forum thread for this show once it posts. Thank you all for the props in the chat room, too. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And cut.
I can loosen the tie after show. Well, I what's awkward is I'm just wearing a tie, so that makes it super. I'm glad we don't do video.
My concern with video is that I'd forget and like pick my nose or something. So I'm just gonna stay away from that.
So you're just okay. Well, that's good to know. Right, let me jot that down. Yeah, nose. Okay, good to know.
See, you know what? I'm glad this is after show. I can delete all this, guys. I'm actually gonna be doing quite a bit of deleting of me from the main show too, because I noticed a couple spots where I'm like
Yeah. But it makes you more real, I think, Gavin, instead of one of these perfect cyborgs.
Here's a little secret. I actually edit the beginning of the show more. I will take out people's ums, I'll clip things and trim them, I'll make sure the gaps are right. So in general, you'll probably notice that the first 30 minutes of the show has been, you know, is really polished, and then as we go on, it gets a little more less, because when you're editing 2 hours of audio, it not only does it get tedious, I also get to the point where I'm like, what the heck? If they're still listening, they like the show anyway. And I should probably wrap up. I kind of want to go home and get dinner. And I hope the talk show recording is good, because my laptop battery actually ran out over here recording at about 1 hour and 45 minutes. So I guess all else fails, that amount of the show is probably plenty for people.
Hey, Gavin, I do have one suggestion that we should throw in the hopper, though, for a future live show. I think it might make sense to sort of be a little more structured and purposeful up front, to just sort of say from in hour one, from 7 to 7:30, we're going to do this. So the panel members even had sort of a general idea of the format we were going to follow.
Right.
Because, you know, I was watching, as I know Dennis was, and, you know, like, we lost a lot of people, dropped out when we sort of got on that whole Facebook thing and just began beating Facebook to absolute death. It seemed like we had a lot of non-photography-related topics that kept kind of really getting expanded. And, of course, with the live format and with some listeners popping in on the chat window, and
sure.
then we respond and expand and to a, cause, you know, we don't have hard commercial breaks where we get to catch our breath and reset, which, again, doing this live radio thing I've been doing a little bit of, that's really nice when you have a guy who forces it, forces a break when he holds up a piece of paper that says, you know, break in 30 seconds.
Exactly.
And you,
well,
you get, and we don't have that luxury necessarily. So,
no.
But I think we could almost, I think we could be, and, you know, Dennis or myself or somebody, we could kind of, we could certainly play Time Cop a little bit and say, okay, time's up on that. Let's move on
to.
I have the outfit if I'm Time Cop, so we're
set. Time Cop. That's actually a cool name, timecop.com.
Yep. Yeah. Registered. Hello.
Check it out. I think that's good. In fact, basically all my structure went to pot on this one because I had no idea how it was
going to
go.
You know, tangents are going to happen, but maybe we should all just say, you know what, we just really have to limit our tangent response to X number of minutes. And then
TRF.
Uh-huh. And then we hit the buzzer, hit the gong or something, and say, okay, enough, let's move on.
Hey, Dennis, do you think you could do a sound effect with your mouse that's based on TERT, like TRT? What can you do for us?
Well, that could get really bad. I'm not even going to try that. do you want to lose your clean tag for the podcast?
Oh, forgot to mention the new live Lightroom workshops.
Well, you can do it in the after show, and then it's like a reward if they... If they listen to 2 hours and 10 minutes of awesomeness, they get to the end, little nugget. Now, save
it
for the next one.
But if I shove it down their throat in the beginning, it's a reward for me because I make money. Anyway, for those still listening, if this makes it to the after show, I'm going to start doing the Lightroom workshops online with webinars and kind of broken down into bite-sized chunks so you can check it out on the site. But I will mention it on the next show. It'll come around. I completely forgot about it. And people get annoyed if I talk too much, put too many ads in there anyhow.
You're awesome.
The rants and rabbit trails. I love it.
I don't care what anybody says, you know.
Hey, Gav, can we get AWJ in here? He's got his hand up, and you got to give the guy dedication for sticking around into the after show like this.
If you are in the after show, you're on because no one sticks around that long.
I think I'm here now.
Yep, you are.
I made it to the after show.
See, there's excitement. What do you got,
well,
Andy? Where are you?
The reason I was raising my flag was to second how good the Lightroom Live stuff is, because I had it back when you first did it. I learned almost 90% of everything I know about Lightroom in that one.
Well, this will definitely make it into the after show.
I had been studying it a lot and finding all these tutorials, but then that four-hour session, I don't know if you're doing 4 hours again.
Go ahead, sorry.
That was just, it was intensive, and you covered pretty much anything and everything that was there. And I would love for you to come to the Midwest so I can actually do an in-studio training session with you, but you seem to be going to the West Coast still. I don't know why.
I want to go further than that. It's just the West Coast is closer, and to be honest, it's hard. Everywhere I go, people say, come here, and then as soon as I go there, they want me somewhere else instead. And it's expensive to do the travel and to go there. It's tough because I don't have, you know, I'm not like the superstar photographer that everybody knows. So if I'm coming into town, it's not like that I just automatically sell out the house. So I want to go further and back toward the Midwest. And so I'm working out the marketing side of doing these workshops and stuff like that. But the problem is for like Lights and Shadows, where it's a 2-day intensive workshop, it's more legitimate for people to travel in. But for a Lightroom workshop, you know, they're not going to want to come from across the country. I've had someone come from as far as England for my HDR stuff to come to that workshop. But Lightroom workshops, it's a little harder. But anyway, I'm glad you liked it. And I'm changing the format a little. What I'm doing is I did that first online Lightroom workshop, Andrew, and there was a few hitches. It worked, and it did pretty well, but it was cramming so much in such a small time. It was kind of stressful. There were some technical issues. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to have a series of inexpensive webinars that are about 90 minutes long is what I'm going to try, and they're going to be really focused. So for people that are really new, number one will be really getting a grasp on the catalog, understanding importing images, you know, starting from the basics
and not trying to rush through it. And then it's going to go all the way. There's going to be five or six of these that cover on different things all the way through into like Lightroom Prodigy stuff, where we're really getting into nerdy Lightroom stuff. And that way we can really focus on, you know, somebody can book the session and join in on the workshop that really fits what they want to learn about and where they're at.
Yeah, that would be absolutely awesome thinking back about it, because I don't know if I really retained almost everything. I retained a lot, but I know there was some finer details that you had touched on, but we kept moving, and it just kind of, you know,
it's so fast.
It wouldn't stick. Yeah.
Yeah, it's something I deal with at the workshops when I'm in person, too, because it's like 7 or 8 hours, and I'm cramming so much. And somebody actually, a guy in the photographer's organization who used to be on the road a lot teaching workshops, and he said, Gavin, everybody doesn't think as crazy as you. You have to slow down. And these people, you're doing all this stuff, and it's great, but the rest of the world is not absorbing the stuff at the same speed as you're putting it out there. And I started thinking about that, and it started making sense, because sometimes, you know, I'll sit there and there's two sides. I'll be in a workshop, and some people will be pretty used to Lightroom and understand it, and other people will be talking for 45 minutes, and I'll be trying to get their head wrapped around the catalog and get them to understand that. I think it's going to be cool to break it up like this. It's going to be less stressful because they're going to be short, bite-sized chunks, and each one is going to really take a grouping of topics and really focus on it and really deal with that. So anyway.
Divide and conquer.
Yeah, it's a good thing this is the after show, because I just turned this into a huge ad for my new Lightroom website. Which you can find it.
A shout out, you mean?
A shout out, yeah. Hey, shout out,
but
for Gavin.
But hey, you have a former customer absolutely saying it was awesome.
If I can get a testimonial, I will carry it like a banner and run with it.
I've noticed that.
Hey, Gavin.
Yeah.
Just a tip. Don't refer to him as a former customer, though.
If I have an active customer who I am very fond of, that, you know, can shout out, air quotes, to other people about this. Okay, that's right. That's where I got it confused. If I'm referring to myself, it's shameless self-promotion. When Andrew or one of you other guys mentioned something, you know, that's a shout out. It's like, hey, check this out, it's cool. But when I think the difference, Dennis, is that when I'm talking about me, it's not a shout out. Yeah, that's what I got to work out. So here's the thing: I actually rehearse the parts where I'm doing the shameless self promotion, because I know people, you know, people are interested, but they don't. I don't want them to feel like Pro Photo Show is an ad. But I try to make it efficient and not go on all day about it, which I'm doing right now. But this is the after show, so I can do that.
Gavin, I was thinking about when you were listing all your websites. You've got so many websites now. You're going to have to create a list and just read through them like every time.
That's why I say go to Syme Studios, because Syme Studios, that is like, that's basically what that website is. SymeStudios.com is like a directory for all my websites. You go there and there's an icon for each site, from Pro Photo Show to portraits. And you can pretty much find everything from there, because otherwise it sounds ridiculous. If I listed all my websites and Facebook pages, I mean, there would literally be, I have like 7 or 8 Facebook pages, and a couple of which are primaries, and 7 or 8 websites. So just go to the site and...
Yeah.
And then there's Dennis. Dennis doesn't even have a blog yet.
I hear blogging is coming back, so I might jump on the second wave here. But it looks like in the chat room that you're going to be going to Boston, and people want you to stop in Michigan. And Andrew, where are you calling from for people who don't
Indiana,
know where you're from?
Indiana.
So the big SymeFX tour bus will be rolling through the East Coast.
You know what? Here's the thing. Everybody, especially for the HDR workshop, take a road trip. I mean, like, I'm taking a huge road trip every time I go do these workshops. I can only be so many places, because there's only, you know, at this stage. And I'm telling you, from having done it, if you can get like a week or two off, which I know is hard to do, but there is nothing for a photographer like hitting the road and taking a road trip. I got my little trailer and I load up my family. I'm not really into flying these days, the whole pound TSA thing, but I can get a trailer. No, I'm not at all.
It's not that bad.
Gavin, I flew to Tampa and back, you know, last month, and I didn't get touched once. I actually felt a little hurt, you know?
Yeah, you sound disappointed.
A lot of the people don't, but that's not the point. It's a principle. The government isn't allowed to do child pornography just because they're the government. And I'm sorry, but no, it's not acceptable. I'm not saying I will never, ever fly, because there may be, you know, I may have to, but people should stand up. There's this attitude that, oh, it's for our safety, and it's not for our safety. It's theater. They're not protecting us. It's simply a matter of putting us in our place and seeing how much they can get away with. I'm going to get started on a rant here at this rate, but
we're probably going to have to cut this out of the show.
looking at my daughter through a see-through machine that sees through her clothes is not stopping terrorists. Anyway, I probably will cut this out of the show. I can really enjoy talking politics, but that's generally not where I try and go on Pro Photo Show. So anyway, check my Facebook page for my latest rant.
Oh, Gavin, you're something else.
All right, guys. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up. The longer I stay, the more editing I have to do, and most of this after show has to be edited. I think I'll pretty much just leave the spot where Andrew is raving about my workshop, and we'll call that the after show. Sorry, Dennis and Barry. But
I had some good – I had Time Cop outfit. I had –
okay,
what else
fine. I'll leave Time Cop.
I had a – oh, I'm just wearing a tie for the after show. That's pretty good.
Yeah,
not my best, but anyway. All right.
Hey, shout out to all you guys in the chat room. I'm looking at names here. Dan, I see you there, and Nodal, Chat West. Anyway, thank you all, Billy.
Andrew, thank you.
Yes, Andrew and
glad to be here.
Yeah, Barry and Dennis and everybody.
Hey,
so I'm gonna
Andrew, good luck on that Brave season. No, Barry, this is not Andrew Jones, the baseball player. We go through this every time. This is a photographer in Indiana.
No, that's what you think he's me.
Oh, this is the real one.
Quit.
And Kim, I don't know if you're still in there. Kim's been helping me with the workshops down in the Pismo area, organize things. That I know I saw her earlier.
Oh, awesome.
I'm not sure if she's there right now or not. But anyway, are we done?
We're done.
That's it. I'm going to officially end this. Thank you all, and we'll catch you soon. Did I do a nice, tidy end? Thanks for listening to Pro Photo Show, and we'll catch you later or something like that.